Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 284 for comics originally released on January 16th, 2013. Starting us off in DC is Threshold Number 1. This presents The Hunted, this issue. This is obviously the first issue of, I think this is Wave 4 of titles, maybe. They've gotten a little loose on the actual waves, because they've started this at one point, Constantine at another one, etc. $3.99 book. We've got a backup feature in this. Let's start with just the lead feature, which spins out of the Green Lantern New Guardians annual we talked about last week. Now, I'm pretty sure that I left that, and I think you did too, thinking this Jedediah Call, or however you want to pronounce his last name, didn't really need a solo feature based on what we'd seen in that annual. Fair assessment?
I would say yes.
I came out of this lead feature actually very surprised and pleased, because I thought it was a lot more of an ensemble feature than I was expecting.
I liked this issue a lot better than I liked the lead-up to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's saying that I liked it better than the other one. I don't think that this needs to exist particularly.
I disagree with you on that.
That's fine. I mean, for me, let me add to that. I think, okay, it can exist. I'm not going to keep getting it. I thought it was okay, but
let me explain why I think it's a good thing, the approach they're taking on this, and whether it's for you or not, that's fine. But I think this was smart for DC to do, particularly as an ensemble feature, because it's giving DC a chance to kind of reinvent their lesser used space characters. And by lesser used, some of these really haven't seen a light of day in ages. And maybe one or two of these will click with new readers, spin out into a really successful solo title or something. But if nothing else, it gives them a chance to dust off stuff that really, like I said, hasn't seen the light of day in ages. We got Stealth. She was a member of the Legion and Rebels with all the periods and stuff pre-Flashpoint. This is a totally new version of the character. But we get a new version of Rick Starr, Space Ranger. We get what sounds like it's going to be a new version of Tommy Tomorrow. Based on solicitations, we're getting a revamped Captain Carrot even. So it allows them to kind of, in an ongoing story, try out revamped versions of, again, characters that would be hard to do in almost any other title and setting. So I really think the approach they're taking here is actually kind of brilliant. Whether the execution and the story turns out that way, that's another matter entirely. And I do agree that there are going to be people who look at this, try it, and say, you know, I don't need to buy this. But if it can do enough to hang on and survive, this may work out as a new feature test bed or whatever, much better than DC Universe Presents has.
In the context of DCU's space characters, mm-hmm. Which looks like where they're going with it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't like this Hunted framework.
That's the main reason.
And then the other part about it is I don't like the $3.99 price. The main story and backup story, other than when they put the $3.99 price tag on their big books like Batman and Justice League and such, it just seems like when they try it on these kind of books, they go down in flames after 6 to 12 issues. I don't know why they keep beating their head against that $3.99 book with the backup feature wall.
Let's talk for just a second on Batman and the backup feature, because the issue that came out this week was another one of those. You got the lead feature, and the backup feature pretty much was almost a continuation or an aside or a sidebar or whatever for that main feature.
Right, and I feel like I just get a longer Batman comic, and I like that, right? Because I'm buying Batman, so I'm getting more Batman. Here,
but that's the only title right. That's doing that.
Yeah. Here, I get The Hunted, and then I get a Larfleeze story. Mm-hmm. It's like, I liked the Larfleeze story a lot more than I liked The Hunted story. If I was just getting a Larflee story, I'd probably buy it, but I'm not going to buy this $3.99 book to read the backup feature. I felt that way about a lot of their books like this, you know, G.I. Combat and...
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about this before, and I really think that if DC could find a way to take these backup features, which are what, about 10 pages, split them out into a $1.50 book and just let that stand on its own and then have the lead feature at the $2.99 or whatever, it could benefit both sides. It would give them an avenue to be doing a couple of slimline books or whatever you'd want to call them.
Even if they just do them digital first, like those Batman stories, you have the 10-page Larflee story for 99 cents online.
Yeah, collect the three issues.
And then when you get three issues, you collect them or
that
something. And that way, you know, if I just wanted to read the Larflee story, I would buy one comic that's 30 pages of Larflee story.
I really don't think the split feature book is a good idea in this market, because unless you like both features, people are going to feel, well, you know, I'm not going to pay $3.99 for just the lead. I'm certainly not going to pay $3.99 for a half-size backup feature. It's a losing battle. And that's why I'm so impressed with what they're doing on the Batman book, where it just seems to expand the page count for the main story. Now, talking about the Larflee's one for a moment, I found it actually a lot of fun. I particularly enjoyed the ending of it, which really kind of got me interested in what happens next. I'm not going to say it was a particularly deep story. It was, fairly simple setup. I liked not the first page, but the second splash page there, where we first see the inside of his cave or what have you. There are a ton of little Easter eggs and stuff that I found kind of, amusing. Everything from the TARDIS to Morbius's chair to a dead guardian to what I think was the Viking prince's ship, Magneto's helmet, the Silver Surfer's surfboard, the fuzzy dice. It was just, the artist had some fun, I guess.
You got like a big penny with a dinosaur head on it. It's just...
Mm-hmm. Clearly an homage to the Batcave penny and stuff.
Even what looks like the Legion's first headquarters up in the top right corner. Maybe a little smaller, but that spaceship-looking thing with the checkboard.
It could just be a rocket, but what was almost kind of to the top left of it could be a sideways version of the Legion of Doom headquarters. Hey, there's a ton of little Easter eggy things in there, which is fun. And the other thing I thought was interesting is Larflee's biographer is Stargrave, presumably Pulsar Stargrave, who really long-time readers of Legion of Superheroes might recognize as a villain from, ages ago, who I believe turned out to be a future version of the original Green Brainiac who'd fled to the future to avoid or escape Superman. Obviously, this is current day. We'd already seen pre-Flashpoint a revamped version of Pulsar before, who'd been created by, I guess... Vildrox of Legion, or his son Lyle or whatever. Anyways, this is another one where they're using the opportunity to take some of the characters that have kind of been just hanging around unused in the DC library and bring them back. So this one seems like it'll be a fun thing. But you're right, if this had just been its own book. Or maybe a backup feature in New Guardians or somewhere where it seems like it would have fit much more logically. I think a lot more people might read it.
Mm-hmm.
This is one, like you said, anytime they do these $3.99 books, particularly like they've done with the G.I. Combat Men of War and what did they call the newer one of that? The G.I. Combat was in.
I don't even remember.
Blanking on the name.
Yeah.
But,
one of their old war titles.
Yeah.
Star Spangled War,
No.
It's just, you can't even remember, so it tells you how.
Exactly.
And you probably bought it, so.
I bought all seven or so issues.
I skipped it. There's nothing bad about this. I didn't dislike it. I just didn't like it enough that I felt compelled to add it to my pull list.
Yeah, it was G.I. Combat, by the way.
Yeah. It came up being like a 3 out of 3 for me, a 3 out of 5 rather for me. It was just, but right, that's just not enough to make it onto my list.
Mm-hmm. I can see it. That's pretty much where it landed for me. Maybe a little bit of a high 3, but not quite enough to get it into that 4 category. And I felt that way both for the lead feature and the second feature. Now, this is something that I think the title shows promise and could grow into something good, particularly the lead feature, depending what characters they bring in and what they do with them. But this is one where I think new titles, particularly what's a de facto anthology here with two features, they need to start much stronger than this. And given the lifespan of some of these other titles, if this sticks around for a full 12 issues, that might be impressive, you know? And that's unfortunate because they're telling some decent stuff here. So liked it a lot more than I expected, but mainly because I didn't think that New Guardians Annual was the greatest lead-in possible.
Yeah, that's about where I was on it. I thought it was an okay comic. But I think marketing-wise, I would rather see a $2.99 book set with their space characters, but something other than this hunted storyline. And yeah, maybe it'll evolve into that, but you know, I think they're kind of gone down the path where they're going to ride this $3.99 thing with the backup feature until they end up canceling it.
The problem I have with the hunted aspect is not only is it just a lame reality TV kind of riff or whatever, it's the ultimate in writing crutches almost. Okay, let's have characters talk for a little bit, get a little exposition, character, plot, and then when we need something to do, boom, suddenly somebody attacks. Because everybody's hunting these guys down. They could be attacked at any time.
That's a good point. It's like you got your built-in action scene every now and again by just having some random people come up without having to explain it other than the fact that they're being hunted. They're hunted, yes.
So I think that's an easy out on the writing side, which is unfortunate for when they actually have to work for their job.
Shall we move on to Savage Wolverine number 1?
Yeah, what'd you think of this one?
You know, I bought this because Frank Cho was doing it, and mm-hmm. I liked the Frank Cho art.
Hard not to.
It's Frank Cho. I think he's a great artist. Right into my taste. I think the story had some weak points to it. I think Frank Cho is a much better artist than he is a writer.
Fair enough.
But, you know, overall, I liked it, and I'm going to keep on getting it.
I mean, for my money, it's hard to go wrong with a Frank Cho title. I mean, he's an amazing artist. Given his track record, I'm kind of curious how likely this is to for this title to both be monthly and by Frank Cho over the course of, say, a year. I don't know that he's really got that kind of track record in place. I hope he can do it, because, I mean, again, I love looking at his art. This got a little gory in places with the decapitation and a few things like that, but not excessively gory. There were a couple of things on the writing that you're right, just kind of sort of happened to get the story rolling. But I mean, I'm kind of okay with that. To me, this is falling in the roller coaster ride story mentality, kind of like a Chuck Dixon story usually does, where things happen, you get some action, some turns and stuff. But if you stop and think about it too hard, it may fall apart. But that ricketiness gives it a sense of anything can happen as you're reading it. And I have no idea how or if this fits into Wolverine's life outside of this title, but not really too concerned about that either. This is a fun series, and it should continue to be fun as long as Cho is on it. Again, he's doing some great stuff with the art. The only thing on the art that kind of made me say, hey, when did this happen? Apparently Wolverine is now sporting high top sneakers instead of the generic superhero boots that he normally has. The lace up aspect just seems
that mystifies me. But
not a big deal.
It's the same thing as why Shanna feels compelled to run around in this bikini. Not that I mind looking at her in this little bikini that's barely covering her, but you know, practically. It's like, nobody else, it's not that hot that you need to be wearing this thing. Everybody else is wearing full clothing.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, that's how the character is, so.
Yeah.
It'd be hard to pick her out of the lineup if she was just, like, in a S.H.I.E.L.D. outfit or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, I give them that, right? You got to do that, but.
I really enjoyed this. I thought it was fun. I'm going to keep going with it, and I hope that Cho stays on it. I can, like, you know, maybe get some coaching on the writing and stuff. He did a good job, but you're right. It could be stronger. It could be tighter. This could be a very fun ongoing Wolverine series. It just depends. Can they keep it going?
Yeah. I'm just, I'm adding this to my poll, but, you know, we'll have to see where it goes. You know, if it goes 4 issues and then they bring in, you know, some other artist for 3 issues, we'll have to see. You know, it depends on who that artist is. I mean, there are some artists that, you know, you could just sustain this, you know, and just like, okay, we're going to rotate artists, but it's, you know, like they do on Daredevil, where, I mean, they have to do that because they ship it, they're doing the multiple shipping on that one. But even if they don't do the double shipping on this, if Cho's not quick enough to keep up with a monthly book for the long term, if they bring in somebody who's of a similar style, right? Not Frank Cho, but, you know, similar.
The names that come to my mind, Terry Dodson, Aaron Rusty, possibly Kevin Maguire.
Exactly. Exactly. Those guys, you know, you could keep this going.
You'd have to have, again, some good writing to go with it. But frankly, most of those guys also do some writing. So they could do a similar kind of solo creator kind of a run for story arcs. And frankly, that would be something that would be a lot of fun, is just to see it rotating, stories that are, you know, not, you know, necessarily 5-6 issues in length, but do a couple of in and out, you know, quick action adventure stories in 2 or 3 issues or something, or single issues.
You know, and almost, I'm going to hate myself for saying this almost as soon as I say it, but it's Savage Wolverine. It's set in the Savage Land. If they did the arc with Savage Wolverine and then they changed it to, you know, Savage Hawkeye, and they did an arc with Hawkeye in the Savage Land, you know, and they keep Shanna and Kazar, who I assume will pop in at some point, maybe not because they're on this island, but, you know, but kind of keep it in the Savage Land with these characters and have different characters kind of roll through it. That might be interesting.
I'm trying to think who would be like the least likely person or most awkward to put into a Savage situation. You know, somebody who's like the most refined, uptight, you know what I mean, that kind of a thing. Kind of the Felix Unger of the Marvel Universe, whoever that
Emma
might be.
Frost or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah, that would be fun. And it would be an interesting way for them to essentially do a backdoor Savage Land series. I don't know if that's where they're going with this. They've done a few things set in the Savage Land that just seem to get dropped without explanation. I mean, the last time I think we saw some of these characters was the Scar, who was king of the Savage Land there for a little bit and then suddenly wasn't. I don't recall if they really resolved that or if it just...
That's true. They had some issues of that Scar Son of Hulk series that were set there. I wasn't reading the series at that time, but I was kind of seeing it go by.
Well, they did a whole miniseries or whatever, and then he was over in Thunderbolts or whatever. And I don't know that they really resolved, you know, kind of what happened to the Savage Land after that.
Mm-hmm.
No real mention of that here, which is fine. I don't think Wolverine needs to go clean up that mess, but it's a lack of continuity and closure that I don't think right. really helps the Marvel Universe at times.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of places like that.
So. Yeah, I'm not saying it's unique to the Savage Land or whatever, but yeah.
I liked how they set up, you know, Cho did set up some interesting elements there. You got a strong S.H.I.E.L.D. presence down in the Savage Land. They're doing some surveying. I mean, there's just, and the reason that the Savage Land thing clicked with me is because he seemed to set up a lot of things that were Savage Land related that could go on for longer. That, and I know they don't really worry about this kind of stuff, but, you know, just keeping Wolverine in the Savage Land setting for more than 4 or 6 issues, it becomes problematic with him being in 15 other Marvel books if you worry about those kind of things, which admittedly most people don't. So,
but by not worrying about it and not addressing it, it really makes it seem ludicrous that he's in all of these titles, which builds up the cynicism, which I think is a counter sales factor.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, does it matter for the Savage Wolverine title if he's there for multiple years of stories solid with no breaks to go do any of his X-Men adventures? No, if it's a great title, fine. However, at the back of a lot of people's minds, it's going to be, well, if that story doesn't matter to the Wolverine character, why should it matter to me? And I can understand that, and I think that's a very valid thing that in a shared universe to the creators and editors need to be concerned about. Anything that chips away at the plausibility and the believability, I don't want to use the term realism, of course, of these stories, though, really eats away at the incentive to go get them and buy them and read them. So.
Yeah, well, you don't want to just totally blow a hole through the suspension of disbelief. I know it always seems, you know, somebody just kind of walks in on people having these kind of conversations. They're like, well, you'll believe a man can, you know, have adamantium bones and go around and do this and that, but then you won't believe this other thing. And the answer is kind of like, yeah.
Well,
you know,
let's
talk
about that for a minute. I'll believe he has adamantium bones. He's really long lived. He's got the healing factor, all that stuff. Because that's the premise of Wolverine. And to my mind, a story is kind of a de facto contract between the creators and the readers. And they get to set the premise and the start of the story, lay their own ground rules. And my only expectation is if I accept those givens as the premise and stuff as set forth, that the rest is going to flow through kind of logically. Maybe not logically in a predictable, well, of course, it's got to happen this one way, not like predestined or anything. But if you set up Wolverine as a man and time flows normally, he can only be so many places within a certain time frame or whatever. So for him to be in the Savage Land, for him to be, I think, on Mars right now with the Avengers, over at the school with Wolverine and the X-Men, and, you know, the other half dozen places he is at the moment. Okay, those may have to get rearranged in time a little, but they can fit a timeline for what they're treating as a single character. It gets a little messier, of course, this whole contract concept between creator and reader when you've got multiple creators, multiple stories. But again, I will accept Superman's an alien from Krypton because that's the premise. I'm not going to accept certain things that either fly in the face of the premise or just make no story logic sense. And we've reviewed this a number of times and gotten into a number of discussions of things that kind of drive you nuts with, wow, the city streets are not that narrow. It's just that the artist hasn't seen what he's drawing or whatever. And one of the hot button items for me is if you set something up and are creating your own ground rules, and it's not just at the beginning, it's as you go, and then start violating them. To me, that's not a writing crutch. That's lazy. That's bad writing. And it seems to me like the writer's not doing their job. I mean, Frank Cho sets up a bunch of stuff here with this technology nullification field and all that kind of a stuff. And if suddenly, without explanation, you know, they're on walkie-talkies or whatever using technology and it just suddenly works, and there's no ever mention as to what happened, it's just, oh yeah, we found the walkie-talkies, we charged them, we're good. I'm going to be like, what the hell? You know, that violated the premise you set up. Your rules, play by them. So yeah, I'll accept surprisingly ludicrous things in a premise, but if things don't kind of flow naturally from what they've set up, that bothers me. So we'll see if they ever address Wolverine being in other titles in this series or not. And frankly, if the quality maintains as it is, I don't care. It's a fun Wolverine story.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like this is the kind of book where, and I think a lot of books go this way, because most people don't get anywhere near all the Marvel books. So, you know, if somebody's getting 5 or 6 Marvel books or 10 Marvel books, as long as within the context of those books, everything's okay and there's not a lot of inconsistencies, and then that's fine. Or if somebody just loves Wolverine and they're going to buy every single Wolverine book and appearance and they don't really care about consistency, they just want to see Wolverine, well, that'll work too for that person. I like Cho. I'm going to read this. You know?
I think what they buy is less of a factor than what they're aware of. There could be people reading New Avengers who are aware that the Fantastic Four is off in space for a year who start to wonder, well, if that's the case, how can Reed Richards be in New Avengers right now? You know, and vice versa. Whether people read both the stuff, it comes down to if they're trying to do a shared universe and they're doing things that violate, or not violate, but are inherently inconsistent, people just need to be aware of them, not necessarily actually reading those titles.
Well, I will give you that. However, I'm reading New Avengers, and that thought did occur to me as I was reading issue number two. But at the same time, since I'm not reading Fantastic Four, it kind of, I was aware of it, but it didn't nag at me that much because I'm not actively reading the...
It may not nag at you. It may not bother you at all. And it may not even hit your radar unless somebody mentions it. But those things, I think, the more they do them, the more they slowly chip away at the cohesiveness of the universe. The more that gets chipped away at, the less of the whole shared universe benefit there is to Marvel and DC, which are the main ones that go do this. Most other places with shared universes have like four titles. It's easy to juggle that many. And the whole concept of let's do a crossover to get readers from one title to another becomes kind of a pointless exercise if there's no reason to think it's really a cohesive universe. It's I'm not saying people are going to see that and just suddenly start dropping books left and right. I think that's ridiculous. But it's something that these guys have editors. A lot of these things, the editors are dealing with all the titles that are inherently inconsistent. And the fact they don't even worry about this at all, I think, is incredibly short-sighted and counter to optimizing sales. But that's just my thoughts. So for me, Savage Wolverine, strong 4 out of 5. I think Cho's doing some great work. Hope he keeps it up.
Same here. Added to my pull list. First time I've had a Wolverine book on my pull list since probably that Enemy of the State storyline.
Wow, that's
how long ago that was.
5 years, maybe more. No, that's
So I'm liking it.
Cool. Shall we move on to our other book for the week?
The Highways by John Byrne. Did you get the regular cover or the DCBS cover?
Based on the DCBS shield there at the bottom, I'm going to say I got the DCBS cover.
Oh, there you go.
The retailer incentive cover, to be honest. I wish they would have done what they do on some of the other books where they show all the different covers on the inside front. That's always fun.
Yeah, I've noticed that lately. When I've been flipping through some of these books that have, and it's not just IDW, but other publishers have stopped doing that as much.
Dynamite's the one that mainly does it.
Yeah.
This was an interesting book. I mean, I enjoy most of John Byrne's work. I think his Star Trek work at IDW was a lot of fun, and this has given him a chance to tell kind of a sci-fi story completely under his control. And I wasn't entirely sure what to expect from the series, and I kind of think it's fair to say I'm not entirely sure what I got from this issue in certain respects. And let me explain what I mean by that, because I enjoyed this issue. But while we got a solid introduction to the main characters and relevant aspects of the life around them and almost immediately around them, there were a couple of really odd kind of unknowns that are kind of nagging at me, like, really, you didn't bother to address this at all? I mean, why did this ship hire a rookie navigator sight unseen, apparently through some contracting company, I guess? And it's like, okay, you've done Sims, that's it, but you're hired. We're going to have you start navigating us right now. It's like, that seems a little odd. Don't they know anybody who can navigate? Don't they have anyone with any experience? How did they find this guy? Who did they contract through? It's just, I don't know. And then not only do they do that, but, oh, he doesn't have his own spacesuit, and he needs that. Oh, so the people who hired him gave him bad information, or who found him and got him the job, didn't do a great job, gave him bad information, whatever. But that's okay. The first officer's going to go get him his own spacesuit, and he can just work off the payments. She's just met the guy. How does she know he's good for it? He's not going to get killed. He's not a serial killer or whatever. I mean, I don't know. It was convenient. And we spend a fair amount of time in this, actually just a couple of pages, I guess, in the initial space station there, getting the lay of the land and a few things like that, and then immediately leave it. So I'm not sure if this adventure they're having on Europa is just like the away mission of the moment, using kind of a Star Trek / SG-1 kind of analogy, where every episode they go somewhere, have an adventure, come back, and it's as if that, I don't want to say gets forgotten, but it's not germane to their ongoing life. Or if this is kind of a key part of the bigger picture for the series, if there even is going to be a bigger picture for the series. Because I really don't know what direction the series is going to take. And I'm kind of okay with that, because I think Byrne is telling a very interesting, compelling story. We're getting to know these characters. We're getting deeply immersed in this, you know, setting and stuff. And he covers a lot of ground for a first issue. But he didn't really give me a clear sense of direction, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I can't disagree with any of that. I think a lot of the inconsistencies you point out fall into the, if you think about too many of these things too hard.
Roller coaster ride, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's when they start, you know, there are stories where everything is, it seems like the writer has meticulously planned out the entire world and causality between things. And then there are ones where you kind of have this, okay, I want to hit these story beats and I want these cool things to happen. And then you put the characters onto that roller coaster and you're kind of riding them through to get them to these different story points. And, you know, both have their merits. Byrne seems to be going for the second one here, because I agree. I mean, there were these points that you mentioned. I didn't think about them too hard while I was reading the story the first time. I mean, the one that really jumped out to me was, you know, just the whole, you're going to fly 8 months out to Europa for a, you know, a pickup, you know, without, and then you get there and they're like, hey, who the heck are you? You know, it's just like, you know, if I'm going to go 8 months to some place, I might like call them and say, hey, you know, what's the story with this? And, you know, not be a surprise when I get there, but.
Well, they thought they had the contract locked down. Yeah. So, and I think they didn't feel the need for that. But then the question is, how did that happen and why did they get there? And they're like, what the heck?
But I mean, it seems like it's so remote. So it's just weird.
Well, and that goes back to, we get the aspects of life immediately around them, but not the bigger picture. Is this unusual to do an 8 month trip, or is this just nearby and there are trips that take a few years to go do? You know, 8 months was longer than this crew was expecting for this run, but not necessarily that it was an unusual length of time. It just wasn't addressed. You know, we don't know what these guys, Jack and Jonesy, what they're usually, what their runs, how long they usually last and stuff. So, I mean, again, roller coaster ride's a good way to put this. It is only a 4-issue limited series. Whether we see more after that or not, don't know. This is something that certainly the first issue, I think, was written such that it would be equally appropriate for an ongoing. But, you know, again, I enjoyed it. I like John Byrne's art. I like when he has a chance to kind of stretch and just do stuff under his complete control. It gives him, I think, some creative freedom that works well with him. If you don't like John Byrne's art, don't like his writing, you're not going to pick this up anyways. He's got a highly consistent style. There are a couple of places where some of these characters looked, you know, very familiar to other characters we've seen Byrne draw before, but that's just his style.
Yeah. I liked it. I mean, it was a decent story. I mean, kind of picking at some of the things here, but I enjoyed the art. I enjoyed the characters. I enjoyed the setting. It's just kind of, one of the, I guess, you know, hard science type of, you know, with hard science sci-fi kind of a thing. You know, it's just everything on here. They haven't done anything that's theoretically outside of the realm of possibility for today's technology in the future. You know, they don't have warp drive. They don't have transporters or anything like that, right? This is the kind of thing that, okay, this is something that realistically, right, could happen.
Well, yeah, he's not far-fetched with the level of science and stuff, and I think that's a strength for the property, but an aspect of the writing. I don't want to say a crutch, I don't want to say a weakness, but there are a couple of places where the characters are explaining certain things, just to show how realistic stuff is with the gravity, with the microgravity aspects of the space system. The, oh, we got to put you to sleep. Here's why, you know, do you dream, whatever. Some people that'll turn off, other people will really get jazzed about that. And it could, in the hands of Byrne, it works. Similar sorts of things, if it was done by, say, Straczynski, would have driven me up the wall, because he tends to have a look how clever I am aspect to his writing at times. And Byrne's just pointing out, no, I'm trying to, you know, again, do real science or realistic, you know, stay within the bounds of believability. And he did a good job with that.
Right. So no, I thought it was a good, solid book. I gave it a good 4 out of 5. I'm definitely on board for this miniseries, and I want to see where it goes.
Yeah, same here. 4 out of 5. Good stuff. I enjoy Byrne's work. Glad to see him doing, you know, continuing to do some creator-owned stuff. I'm going to be curious to see what he does after this. I enjoyed Trio, too. And this seems a lot less derivative than a lot of people felt Trio was.
Yeah, that's what I like about it. I mean, I like Byrne's work, and I liked when he did those Jurassic Park issues. I don't know if you read those.
No, I didn't read those.
You know, but it's like kind of like that series was kind of a murder mystery. You know, a pteranodon was killing people, and in the Southwest, it had gotten off of Isla Nubla or whatever the place was called in Jurassic Park, and you had the local sheriff
Jurassic
going after
Park
it.
Mystery. I'm sitting here thinking you've got a raptor or whatever with a deerstalker hat and a magnifying glass. That's just what I'm picturing.
But, I mean, it was a good series. I mean, you had, you know, just local law enforcement, you know, the sheriff out on his own trying to solve, you know, the killings and some other characters, and you got the Byrne art, and, you know, it was kind of like nothing like this, but in other ways like this, because it wasn't superheroes. It was in this particular setting, and it was just, you know, a story.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just as if anybody... if that sounds interesting to anybody who's a Byrne fan and they missed it, they might want to look for that on the back issue market, or they probably have a trade of it too.
Makes sense. It's good to see him, you know, actively working and doing a lot of stuff, because I think there have been a couple of years where it's just he's not really putting much out, at least not that I've noticed. But anyways, good stuff. And I like a good sci-fi story, you know, space setting, and we don't get much in that kind of venue these days, I think. At least not much that's literally Star Trek or Star Wars or, you know, Doctor Who. We don't get much in the way of this kind of creator-owned, new universe, new premise type stuff, space fiction.
Mm-hmm. It's good stuff.
Yeah.
Good thumbs up for it. There was another book that came out this week I just wanted to bring people's attention to because it might miss their radar. I did not buy it. I did not pre-order it, but I read the preview, the press preview online, and then I liked it, and I went out and bought it. It's called Todd, the Ugliest Kid on Earth. It's an Image creator-owned book, and it's just a fun. It's a comedy. Mm-hmm. It's a comedy series, is what it is, and what I liked about it is you have this this kid, he's so ugly, just in deference to everybody else, he goes around with a paper bag on his head. So you don't really see how ugly he is. But it's just he's this sweet little kid, and you know, he's in this world of like these real jerks, you know, everyone else, and there's these bullies who pick on him. His parents are terrible, terrible people. You know, there's this serial killer going around the town killing kids, and there's an encounter there that I don't want to ruin, but I mean, it's just, it's written by a guy who writes screenplays, and he actually won a prize from the, Motion Picture Academy fellowship for his writing, not of this, but you know, of other things. But I just point that out because he's a decent artist, he's a decent writer rather, and it's put together really nicely. And the art's by M.K. Perker, who did that Vertigo series Air, which I think you read, and also the original graphic novel Cairo,
right?
Also from Vertigo. So I mean, I like the art. It's not going to be for everybody, but if you see it in the store, you might want to flip through it. It's just got, it's got kind of a twisted sense of humor about it, but it's funny. And you just see this little kid who's the ugliest kid on earth, but he's just, he's the sweetest kid and, you know, the nicest person in this series, in this world populated by these really terrible, terrible people. So it kind of is that allegory on, you know, don't judge a book by its cover kind of a thing. So I enjoyed that, and I'm going to be getting that as it comes out.
Speaking of judging books and covers and so forth, I want to talk just for a moment about The Black Beetle, number one. Francesco Francavilla is doing the art. And I've talked sometimes about how signature style can really kind of get between me and a story and stuff. I'm getting to the point where, as much as I like Francavilla's art, I'm not sure I'm going to keep getting stuff he does. He's got a art tick that is just driving me up the wall. This had 22 pages of story, five of which had his signature on them.
Yeah, I've seen debates about this, and some people get really taken out of the story when an artist is feeling compelled to sign all their pages of art. And I can understand that. You know, to me, what I think is, take the best of both worlds. Let the guy sign all his pages of art that he wants to. But you know what? When you're doing post-production on it, Photoshop the signature out.
That's
when
fair.
It's a story page. You know, just
I don't care what's on the original art.
Yeah.
I care what's on the printed page.
Right. There's no need on a storytelling page to have a guy signing all the pages. And I can see when they're selling the art on the aftermarket, someone might want their signature on the page. But as I'm reading through a story, okay, put it on the first page of the story. Put it on the splash page where there's the credits or something. But when you have five, I haven't read that one yet. Mm-hmm. It's in my pile still. But, you know, I can understand that if you've got multiple signatures all throughout the story, it kind of will serve to take you out of the story.
Well, it takes me out of the story. It makes him seem almost egotistical, you know, like a, you know, let's shine the spotlight, take a bow, kind of, okay, now let's keep going with the story or whatever. And I don't think that's what he means by it. You know, I think his intention is basically towards got his thing on it for the original art market, which I don't have a problem with. But like you said, if they simply photoshopped it out, I think that's a brilliant solution.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting credit on the cover multiple places within the issue. Do I need to have it, you know, on every fourth page almost on average? And a lot of them are the pages that look like they would fetch a premium price on the art market. You know, the splash pages, the things where the, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. No, and I completely understand that. And I do think that that's the kind of thing that when they're digitally producing, I mean, it's back years and years ago when they just, you know, shot photos of these things and did, you know, the low tech version of comic book production. You would have to like physically white out the signature, or, you know, tape something over it or do something to obscure it. Now it's just, you know, click, click, click. The colorist can take it out in Photoshop. You know, it can, you know, any, you know, in post-production, you can take those things out. No muss, no fuss.
Yeah. It feels unprofessional to me. Whether it really is or not, who knows. But it seems like you're, even with the Photoshop aspect, you're still forcing an additional step on the post-production people to take out something that is not there for the story, but there for the artist's recognition.
Yeah.
And again, the art deserves recognition. I'm not arguing that or whatever, but I don't think that's the time or the place for it.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that, not just from Francavilla, from other artists as well, but it doesn't bother me that much, but I can understand that it could.
Yeah. He's the one I'm noticing it the most for, because he's got a longer name maybe, and therefore it takes a little more space. I'm not saying it's unique to him, but yeah.
What'd you think of the new Geomancer? Do you read Archer and Armstrong yet?
I did. I'm really enjoying that. I think they're doing some great stuff with that.
Not who I thought it was going to be. I was kind of thinking that they were going to make it Archer's girlfriend, or you know, the girl he grew up with.
That would have been interesting.
But, I mean, it worked. I mean, they set up a new character for it. I like the character. I like the story. I mean, Valiant is doing such a great job with their books. I have yet to hit that point where it's like, oh, really? They used to be good. You know, they keep on pleasing me every single issue that comes out.
Mm-hmm. Have you read Indestructible Hulk number 3?
I did. I liked it.
The robot thing we saw in the preview pages or preview art for the series, we finally get introduced to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's a little bit of a slow burn there.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. Last panel. I like that. With actually the next issue, little blurb.
Yeah.
It made me smile. I'm curious because I'm not reading some of the other books that the Hulk is appearing in, but they've got a fairly Wade's got a fairly distinctive take on the Hulk. And then going back to our previous conversation about Wolverine, is Hulk being handled in this same way in all the places that he's being seen in the Marvel Universe?
Well, as we talked about when we reviewed the first issue, certainly not. We still have issues of I think it was the Avengers series. No, it was Avengers Assemble, where you know, he's transforming back and forth to the Hulk, and you know
that series almost seems like it's definitely out of continuity. It's just like some side universe of something.
It's very much in continuity, as near as I can tell.
I just said it seemed like it was out of continuity.
Well, it's I'm
just,
saying the it issues seems of like it, it's yeah. not. So
yeah,
it's inconsistent between that. I'm trying to think where else is the Hulk showing these days. It just seems like a lot of these things are happening within whatever title they're happening in, and the others are just taking a best guess as to what the status quo for these characters are. Yeah. And that's unfortunate. I don't say understandable, because I mean, they've got a handful of editors who could just simply talk to one another.
I understand that they want Avengers Assemble to be in continuity, and it's ostensibly in continuity. I'm just saying that the issues that I've read, the way that they handle the characters in it, which seems different than other places, makes it feel out of continuity to me.
I guess to me, that's why it doesn't seem any more or less consistent with the rest of the universe than other titles.
Okay. I don't read those other titles. So it's just of the books I was reading, that's why I stopped reading that one.
Right. But as somebody who's pretty much reading all of the Marvel Universe, I think I can categorically state
with
some authority that it's, again, no more or less consistent than the other stuff. And again, I get that a lot of people aren't, you know, big sticklers for continuity on compared to titles they don't read, and that's fair. But it comes down to, and we had a little bit of a discussion on this on the forums when there was a discussion on the price point and stuff. It comes down to not all readers are worth the same to stores or to publishers and stuff. And that's not to say certain readers are more important or less, but literally have more financial worth. So if you're doing something that really doesn't impact people who read two or three titles, but could actually be a pronounced negative effect of some sort on people who are reading a plethora of titles, well, do you really want to alienate those who are buying more of your work in favor of those who are buying less of your work? That just seems like bad business. And that's kind of the stand I have on cross-title continuity. I don't expect it necessarily to be in lockstep. Like, you should avoid stories that require that. Things where how Giant Man died being inconsistent across books, I think, is inexcusable and easily avoidable. Just don't show the same scene in more than one book.
Well, it's the difference between consistency and slavish continuity. We've had this conversation a number of times. I expect things to be consistent. I don't expect them necessarily to be in ridiculous, you know, detail by detail lockstep continuity. But I want the same character to act the same way within reasonable boundaries.
Yes.
Across the different titles. And when they don't, and that's the thing, when they don't, that's when I stopped buying, you know, that's why I didn't buy the Defenders. Well, because the way that Doctor Strange acted is not like Doctor Strange ever acted anywhere else before or I think since.
Yeah. But you could argue that about a couple of other Doctor Strange miniseries, one where he had the apprentice and a few things like that, where it just, for that story, it was there and never touched again. And there are a few things I do expect to be in lockstep continuity, but they're few and far between. The Green Lantern, both. Things like that.
When they're showing, or when they're showing the same event from different perspectives, they should go out of their way to make sure that that same thing they're showing from different angles is the same.
Whenever they reference Gwen Stacy getting thrown off the bridge by the Green Goblin from ages back, I expect that to pretty much be consistent looking. Different angle, different moment of the process, whatever. But, you know, if they get the costumes wrong or the bridge wrong or something like that, it's like, hey, this is a key moment for the character. Come on, guys. Stuff like that. But it's the, again, the lack of consistency across titles at times that is sometimes jarring, sometimes completely unnoticeable until somebody actually points it out, at which point it becomes hard to not notice and immediately obvious. But to me, the problem or the grading point, the thing that really, you know, eats away at me to a degree, is not just that it's inconsistent. That's unfortunate. And in some cases, if they're both good stories, I really don't care. It's the fact that the writers aren't bothering to read what everyone else is doing or stay up to speed on what everyone else is doing, because presumably they just don't care, I guess. The editors aren't doing that, which is not only they don't care, in my mind, they're not doing their job. I carry a full-time job. I'm doing the podcast and some other stuff, and I find time to keep tabs on both the full Marvel Universe and the full DC Universe and the Valiant Universe and half a dozen other, you know, narrative universes easily. I mean, I'm running, reading, I think, somewhere between 200 and 250 titles, some of which are miniseries, one-shots, ongoings, whatever. If I were an editor at a company, I would feel compelled to be keeping tabs on what's going on in their, all the books by that publisher. I think it's very doable, and I think it's a necessary part of the editor's day job. If I were a creator, be it artist or writer, on a character like the Hulk, I would feel compelled to keep tabs on what's going on with every other appearance of the Hulk. And maybe say, hey, wait a sec, guys, this is wildly inconsistent with what we're doing. Maybe it gets fixed, maybe it doesn't, but I would feel compelled to do that. That's just me, though. And clearly a lot of editors, creators, publishers don't seem to share that opinion. But I think back in the day when there was more cohesiveness in the Marvel and DC universe, there were better sales. I'm not saying the one necessarily led to the other, but I do think as it became less cohesive, as continuity became an evil thing and got thrown out at many times, sales eroded. Now, they may have eroded anyways, but why increase the problem if you've already got an avalanche going, if you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just my thoughts. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
Pretty much does it for me this week.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss Fables number 125 from DC Vertigo, Young Avengers number 1 from Marvel, and The Answer number 1 from Dark Horse.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.